Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'm Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the Professional Committee of the FCC Board. Before I introduce our guest today, I'd like to tell you to do a couple of housekeeping notes. First of all, everybody, please turn off your cell phones now. We do record all of these and put them on YouTube now, and there's nothing worse than having a particularly good comment or quote, and then you can't hear it because somebody's phone is going off. So if everybody checks their phones now, don't be embarrassed to do it now, but we will embarrass you if it goes off later. Second of all, I'd like to tell you about our next speaker coming up Thursday, and that will be Ruchir Sharma. He is the Managing Director and Head of Global Emerging Markets Equities for Morgan Stanley. He has come out with a book entitled Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles. So that's this Thursday. You can sign up for it at the desk on your way out after this one. Probably many of the same people might be interested in that speech on Thursday. With that, I'd like to introduce Ishwar Prasad. Ishwar was the division chief at the International Monetary Fund for China. He now holds a series of roles. He is at Cornell University. We just had somebody from the class of 86 come over and introduce themselves to him. He is also holding a chair at the Brookings Institution. And finally, he's a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. On an academic level, he's well known particularly for his calculations in terms of what different levels of trade deficit and surplus and other variables may tell you about the fair valuation of currencies. But he's also become much more broadly known as an expert on the Chinese and Indian economies. With that, I give you Ishwar. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith, and other members of the FCC, especially the newly elected officials. Congratulations. It's a real pleasure to be here. In fact, when I was here nearly a decade ago, I was still with the IMF, and I had to preface my remarks by saying that I speak only for myself. Well, I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be speaking only for myself and not representing anybody else. What I'm going to talk about today is the role of the renminbi in the global monetary system. These days, the moment you mention the word renminbi or China, people put down their BlackBerries for at least a minute. Given how important these two topics have been, both from the context of those interested in China, but also more broadly. Now, there is a lot of discussion about the quote-unquote internationalization of the renminbi. And what I'd like to do is actually break it down into two or three constituent parts, because many of the relevant terms and analytical concepts tend to get a little muddied. And this is not just being very academic, because each of these concepts turns out to have very significant substantive value. So when one thinks about the currency, one of the key concepts is that of an internationally used currency or internationalization. And that is something where China has in fact made a great deal of progress. And much of what we hear about, especially the renminbi related business in Hong Kong, is about the internationalization of the currency. And then there is the concept of capital account convertibility, where capital can flow freely across a country's borders. Now, it turns out that neither of these, internationalization nor an open capital account, are necessary or sufficient for each other. But what is important is that both internationalization, the free use of a currency that is accepted quite broadly, both within the region and abroad, and an open capital account are necessary for a country to become one that has reserve status for its currency. So let's break down these three steps and what they entail. Now, being in Hong Kong, internationalization is, of course, what you experience a lot. In particular, we have the increasing amount of trade settlement of renminbi transactions through Hong Kong, increasing amounts of renminbi being provided to Hong Kong through various channels in order to facilitate those transactions. Offshore deposit accounts denominated in renminbi, and in addition, the fact that renminbi-denominated bonds can now be issued in Hong Kong, and indeed, corporations like McDonald's have now been allowed to issue renminbi-denominated bonds on the mainland. And here, there is a lot of interesting activity, and the numbers look very impressive. If you look at trade settlement, for instance, about 8 to 9% of China's trade is now settled in renminbi. And the important thing is, if you look at the trajectory of these developments, the trajectory always looks incredibly sharp, because you're usually starting from zero. But the trajectory does hold a story, because it shows that there is very keen interest in developing the renminbi business. But then as one starts peeling back the layers, the numbers are not quite what they seem. Let's again take the notion of trade settlement. Yes, going from basically 0% of China's trade, which of course is growing in leaps and bounds in itself, going from 0% of that being settled in renminbi to about 8 to 9% is a lot within a very short period of time, just about 2 to 3 years. But it turns out if you look more carefully at the data, and the Chinese officials have been providing this data until about 2 quarters ago when some of us started paying attention to it, what those numbers show is in fact that a lot of the settlement activity is on imports by China. In other words, when exporters from outside China export to China, they're more than happy to accept renminbi as payment. So virtually all of the settlement has been on that side. If you look at Chinese exports and whether Chinese exporters are getting paid in renminbi, the answer is minimal amounts, partly because those on the other side don't want to give up their renminbi, and they may not have that many renminbi to begin with. Then if you look at the renminbi-denominated bonds being issued in Hong Kong, a lot of it is by mainland companies. So it's, again, not the sort of broad-based rush into renminbi finance that one might expect. So it's important to keep this in mind, that the trajectory is very sharp, although it's leveled off a little bit in the last couple of quarters. The numbers are certainly impressive, and they presage very important things to come. But it's not clear that this is really very significant of an enormous potential for the Chinese currency to become an international currency. Nevertheless, internationalization is proceeding. What about capital account opening? Here again, there has been progress, both on the inflow side as well as the outflow side. If you look, for instance, at the expansion of the qualified foreign institutional investor scheme, you probably heard about the substantial increase in ceilings announced fairly recently, and this is part of a much broader move. A number of avenues are being provided for capital to flow in. But far more importantly is that avenues are being provided for capital to flow out. Now, this, of course, was partly because China's government, in particular, the central bank and the State Administration for Foreign Exchange, which manages the FX reserves, were keen to take the pressure off renminbi appreciation by trying to have private markets recycle the money coming in rather than doing it officially through accumulation of reserves. So we've seen a variety of channels for doing this. Corporations are being encouraged to invest more abroad. Banks are increasing their presence abroad. And more importantly, households are being encouraged to take money out. But here again lies an interesting rub. Households, in fact, are allowed to take up to $50,000 out per year. Now, for an economy with a per capita income of somewhere in the range of $5,000 to $6,000, this looks like a completely open capital account. If you can take 10 times the per capita income of the country out, what is left in terms of restrictions? But herein again lies the issue. If you live in New York, if you live in Hong Kong, you can go down to your local mutual fund office, your T. Rowe Price or Fidelity, and buy a mutual fund that gives you exposure abroad. But what is lacking in China is the securities market development, the financial market development that allows capital to flow out at the retail level. And financial market development is actually the critical theme that binds together what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk. The remaining issue now is about whether Chinese currency, the renminbi, can become a reserve currency. Because as I've argued, there's been progress on internationalization, significant progress on capital account opening, but neither of these is enough for the currency to become a reserve currency. So what does it take for a currency to become a reserve currency? Typically, there are 5 criteria that economists look at. One is size. Size is not crucial. After all, if you take Switzerland, it's not exactly the massive economies, one of the massive economies of the world, and I suspect Switzerland would like nothing else right now not to be a safe haven. But they're stuck with that status right now, even though they're a small country. But size does help. And on the size criterion, China comes out pretty well. On a nominal exchange rate basis, market exchange rates, the Chinese economy accounts for about 10% of GDP. If you look at purchasing power parity exchange rates, it's about 15%. China accounted for about a quarter of world growth, again, in purchasing power parity terms, in the worst years of the economic crisis. And China accounts for about 10% of world trade. So size is clearly not an issue. A second criterion is macroeconomic policies. Investors, especially foreign investors, including central banks, need to have confidence that a country will run good macro policies and won't let its currency be devalued. Now, here we look around, look at the major reserve currencies, the Eurozone, the US, Japan. It's hard to argue that any of them have much better macroeconomic policies than China does. In fact, if you look at the Chinese debt level, either explicit or including contingent liabilities, doesn't look that bad compared to the advanced economies. So on the macro policy front, China seems to be doing okay. Flexible exchange rates and an open capital account are typical characteristics of a reserve currency. Again, these two concepts sometimes tend to get conflated. But as you in Hong Kong know very well, of course, you can have a completely open capital account without having a flexible or floating exchange rate. But typically, reserve currencies do tend to float. Now, here again, the world has changed. If you think about Japan intervening or the Swiss National Bank now threatening to impose capital controls, if safe haven money comes into Switzerland, we are living in a topsy-turvy world. But typically, for a currency to attain reserve currency status, capital account convertibility and what usually goes with it, FX flexibility, are important criteria. So China is making progress there, but not there yet. And that brings us to the fifth criterion, which in my view is the game changer, which is financial market development. Because the one significant characteristic that every reserve currency country has is that it has very deep financial markets. The critical aspect of a reserve currency is that investors, especially foreign investors, including central banks, but also private investors, should have relatively safe and relatively liquid instruments that they can hold on to. And this is something that China lacks right now. So if you think about financial market development, there are three characteristics that are important. There is breadth, which is the availability of a broad range of financial instruments. There is depth, a lot of those instruments being available, and liquidity, the fact that those instruments are reasonably well traded so that if a central bank that is holding a country's government bonds as reserves wants to use that cash, it can change it into any currency it wants fairly quickly. And on all three of these criteria, clearly China has a long way to go. And in that sense, I think it's going to be very important for China to focus on financial market development. Now, here again, it's worth stepping back and thinking about the process by which this is taking place. And typically when economists think about capital account opening, what is important is sequencing. The one thing that many crises have taught us is that if you go ahead with capital account opening before you have a good financial system, before you have a flexible exchange rate, things can turn disastrous. Again, the Asian region is a prime example of this, but we've seen this play out in many other areas and regions as well, that if you try to protect your exchange rate, or if you don't have good financial markets that allow you to get capital the right way and intermediate it effectively within the domestic economy, and then your capital account is completely open, you can run into trouble. So China seems to be doing something in a curious way, not having absorbed the lessons, because China doesn't have a very flexible exchange rate. Of course, they did widen the band around the renminbi, but it's still a relatively tightly managed exchange rate. And in addition, their financial markets are not quite keeping pace. Does this make sense for China to move aggressively on its capital account? Now here, let me put on my academic hat for a second and tell you about some research that I had done some time ago looking at whether capital account opening is a good thing. We know that open capital accounts have led to crises, And in fact, if you look at the evidence, the old way of thinking that if a developing country opens up its capital account, it gets more capital, can invest more, grow faster, doesn't seem to be supported by the data. Countries like China have run current account surpluses, and they're growing mightily fast. But it turns out that what is really important with financial market opening or capital account opening is not necessarily the capital, but what comes with the capital. This is what I've called collateral benefits in some of my academic work. The fact that you can get financial markets developing because you have more competition from foreign investors. If you have foreign investors coming in to domestic equity markets, they provide depth, they provide increased liquidity, they can help develop a number of things, including corporate governance. And in fact, this is the way China has been proceeding. If you think about how they bought in foreign strategic investors in order to help or at least prod their Chinese banks to undertake corporate governance reforms, this is exactly the collateral benefits approach. Of course, they did this in 2007 before we realized that looking to Western banks for corporate governance was perhaps not the best place to look. But the idea was sound, and this, in a sense, is what China is trying to do. We've heard Premier Wen Jiabao talk about breaking up what he refers to as the monopoly of the big state banks, but they're very well entrenched. The system works very well for them, works very well for the state enterprises that they fund, and very well for the provincial governments. So those in power, or some subset of them, don't want change. But if you start introducing competition for the banking system through securities market development that allows capital to flow out, having private capital in the banking system, that starts creating competition. That may be an underhand way of doing what they really ought to be doing, which is more frontal steps like interest rate liberalization, but that are a lot harder to implement. So I view it as, in some sense, a strategy by stealth. Now, having said all this, my view is that China's currency is moving towards becoming a reserve currency, but is it really going to become the dominant reserve currency, as some have argued? It's useful to think about where China is on this stand. And here again, what is happening on the ground is very, very interesting. One of the other angles through which China is getting its currency more accepted internationally is by setting up bilateral currency swap lines with central banks around the world. Now, China had this even in the late 90s and early 2000s, but a critical difference has come in. At the time, most of these swap lines were in the form of dollar swap lines. In other words, other central banks were saying to the People's Bank of China, in times of crisis, maybe you can give us dollars. That's changed. There are 17 central banks now that have local currency swap lines with the People's Bank of China. Just this year, the United Arab Emirates, Turkey, and the Reserve Bank of Australia have signed these bilateral currency swap lines. Not huge amounts. If you take the Australian central bank's arrangement, for instance, it's about $32 billion, not huge. And I've spoken to a couple of central bank governors, who shall go unnamed for now, who have relatively modest amounts that they signed. But their view was, these are small amounts. Right now, we can use them for trade settlement purposes. But we know that China's becoming a big player. We know that the renminbi is going to become much more important. And therefore, it's important for us to get a relationship going with the Chinese. And this is one way to do it. And once you have a currency swap line set up, expanding it is a lot easier than starting from scratch. Another interesting fact, the Chinese currency is not convertible. So by the IMF definition, if you hold Chinese renminbi in your government bond portfolio, you cannot count it as reserves. Well, there are three central banks, those of Malaysia, Nigeria, and Chile, that already hold some renminbi. Now, one might argue this doesn't make sense. Why would you hold international reserves in renminbi? And to invoke a line from former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, it's really important to have not a small gun, but a bazooka in your pocket to make sure that you scare off people who want to test you. And now that bazooka, your foreign reserve portfolio, has a little red tinge to it because some of it is in renminbi. But it doesn't matter what the IMF thinks or says. What matters is what markets think. So if you as a central banker say, markets see me holding a lot of reserves, including in renminbi, so they're less likely to test me. then it doesn't matter. The renminbi has started attaining reserve currency status. So I think this move is going to continue. The other interesting aspect which I want to talk about before concluding is basically to talk about whether the renminbi is going to become a major reserve currency. And one part which I think is an intermediate step is that the renminbi is going to become part of the SDR basket, the IMF special drawing rights, I predict in the next 5 years. Why is this? Does the IMF, does China need the IMF? No. But the IMF needs China. Because by bringing the renminbi into the fold of the SDR, the notion is that China can be brought into the fold and made to honor its international obligations through this multilateral process. In fact, at the Nanjing March 2011 conference, Nicolas Sarkozy put this on the table. I was at that conference, and I can tell you that Nicolas Sarkozy can convey passion about international monetary reform like nobody else can. When he spoke about it, you felt that this had to happen, that this is an unstoppable force of nature. And he pushed it in the G20 summit declaration as well, that the renminbi will become a part of the SDR basket. The IMF in 2010, November, said a currency must be convertible to be part of the SDR basket. By November 2011, they had said, well, maybe so long as the currency is freely usable and is actually already held by central banks around the world, maybe it can be part of the SDR basket. So I suspect it's going to happen very soon. So on the final note, China is going to have eventually a reserve currency, and I think over the next decade, we will see not only a much more open capital account, but also the currency attaining reserve currency status. So my sense is that the renminbi will erode, but definitely not displace the dollar status, because the one critical issue, again, is having safe and liquid assets. And the U.S., God bless its soul, is pumping out U.S. Treasury still and providing what the world needs, which are safe in quotation marks, and liquid assets. So I think China is going about this reform like in every other reform in its own way. The process of reforms and fiscal reforms and so on used to be tried out in the province, learn by doing, and roll it out nationally. I had argued in an article with Raghuram Rajan a few years ago that China has reached a process in its development where it cannot do this small steps reform strategy anymore, especially with capital account liberalization and FX flexibility. You either go the whole hog or it's not going to work. Well, the Chinese have proved me wrong yet again. So I call it essentially capital account liberalization with Chinese characteristics. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ishwar. I guess just to start off the questions, and I hope all of you will start thinking of your questions as well, you mentioned that, or you sort of played down the internationalization of the RMB by pointing out that it's overwhelmingly being used for Chinese imports as opposed to exports. But since we know that Chinese exporters at some level would be happy to have RMB to pay their costs, isn't it actually a positive sign for internationalization of the RMB that so much of the demand is in fact lopsidedly of overseas companies, even if they only want it for portfolio diversification?
So the interesting issue here is what the trade settlement numbers mean. Is it truly a demand for renminbi settlement, or is it a way of making a play on the renminbi using renminbi held abroad? And you're right that there may be very good reasons for exporters essentially to hold renminbi abroad rather than bring it in, especially if you believe that the renminbi is eventually going to appreciate. So the point was less about whether the lopsidedness means that one should not take the internationalization seriously, but whether in fact it could be representing essentially a renminbi play that is being facilitated by these internationalization moves. In other words, is the renminbi being truly accepted as an international currency? My answer to that is yes, but one shouldn't get too blown away by the numbers.
Thank you. Who else would, over here, please?
Mark. Mark Michelson with IMA Asia. Thanks very much for that, and some very interesting points. But as you know, we've been talking about the full convertibility of the renminbi being 5 years away for at least the past 20 years. And although you outline the progress, but you also mentioned in your last statement about with Chinese characteristics. What are the limitations? You spent a lot of time in China. From China's point of view, are they really ready to move far enough to even achieve the status that you mentioned, or do you see that as a limitation? Obviously, they've made some progress, but is there an upper limit? Because you could argue that what they've done so far has helped prevent them from suffering some of the ills of the world economy, or at least that's the view of a lot of people.
First of all, I have to take issue with your initial statement. When I used to go to Beijing in the early 2000s, they would always say, we'll open our capital account in 10 years. Now they say, perhaps we'll open it in, actually, a couple of years ago, they said in 5 to 10 years. Now I hear more about 5 years. So this is progress. I have argued, in fact, that what China is doing is developing what I've referred to in a couple of pieces as a Trojan horse strategy, which is essentially trying to use the notion of the renminbi becoming a major global currency to get over the barriers to domestic reforms, because having the renminbi become a reserve currency is a mixed blessing. It certainly helps China in terms of getting senior edge revenues by the fact that it'll have its own currency, but it also increases pressure on the currency to appreciate, which is not so good for trade competitiveness. But if China can get its leadership as well as the general population to sign on to this notion that the renminbi should be made into a global currency, then one can introduce into the conversation the notion of what needs to be done for this to happen. You need better financial markets, you need a more flexible currency, and these are things that the reformers want. They've tried taking the banks on head on, that doesn't work very well, but if you say we have better capital market development, this is going to help the renminbi. You need corporate bond markets in order to get the renminbi denominated safe assets available. Then that changes the reform momentum. So essentially, it's reform by stealth. Now, one might argue that this is not necessarily part of a grand strategy, and it's just sort of happening. So I think it's a fair point that this would be a dangerous game to play if you wanted to undertake reforms. But I think it's a fairly good description of what is happening on the ground, that all of these little moves are introducing much more competition in the banking system. And once you open up the capital account, and if you can do it in a controlled way, which China has been able to do to some extent so far, introducing securities that allow households to take their money out, it has a number of positive effects. It helps in this growth rebalancing effort if households get better returns on their savings. It forces the banks to shape up. So if you can't do interest rate liberalization, you might do a few other things that eventually will shake the pieces loose and help broader reforms.
Okay. Does somebody have a question out there on the veranda that I'm missing? I often can't see you out there. Am I missing anybody? Yes, right out there, please. Actually, two. Why don't we do the one on the left and then the one in the middle, please?
Stand up so you can see me. Just a question about currency regimes overall, since you're a specialist on currency regimes. Would you care to comment about how you see the European Monetary Union and system and how that changes over the next few years?
Let me break that question into a couple of parts. Number one, will the Eurozone hold together in its present form? My view is that it is highly untenable, either on an economic or political level, for the Eurozone's constitution to remain unchanged as it is, because it is clearly not conducive for Greece to remain within the Eurozone, have the sort of constraints imposed on it without a clear path to redemption. And my view is that it's increasingly politically untenable for Greece, for Germany to continue supporting many of the peripheral economies. The big question is, when will things come apart and how? As of now, there aren't strong enough firewalls around Spain and many of the other distressed economies. So if there was to be a meltdown right now, it could have fairly significant consequences. So the Europeans have essentially been taking a strategy of pushing things very close to the cliff, not because they are crazy, but because there is a sense that that is the only way you can get the reform process going. It is a very dangerous strategy, and I suspect that markets are not going to give European leaders much more room in terms of time to get their ducks squared up before things start coming apart. What is happening in Europe is changing the nature of the conversation in regard to currency unions, both in Africa and in Asia. The clear lesson from Europe is that you need very strong institutions, in the case of Europe, at a pan-European level, not just fiscal institutions, but other governance institutions in order to make a fiscal union work. If you're giving up monetary policy, which really is still the primary line of defense in response to external macroeconomic shocks, you need a lot in place to substitute for that. And it's certainly going to set back any idea of closer currency integration in either Asia or Africa.
And out here in the middle table, please. I believe you had your hand up.
Hi there. I'm just wondering about the importance of offshore renminbi hubs. London's positioned itself this year to be the next one. Last year it was Singapore, but they seem to be somewhat bypassed. Do you think that London has more of a real chance of becoming the next renminbi hub?
The Chinese, as is their wont, have taken, I think, a very good approach to not putting all their eggs in the Hong Kong basket. And what they're keen to do is make it clear that this is something that is going to be worldwide. They're looking for other channels through which they can increase the international use of the renminbi, and they're willing to accept all takers. My sense is that they're going to use whatever hubs they see as favorable towards this longer-term objective. But in the back of all of this, of course, is the interesting and important question of where Shanghai features in all of this, because the notion of making Shanghai an international financial center is something they've had for a long time. And as we were discussing earlier, officials in Shanghai are very gung-ho about making Shanghai an IFC, and they felt Shanghai was ready 5 years ago, let alone right now. But in Beijing, the tone is much more cautious. There is a sense that both in terms of the technical trading infrastructure, in terms of regulatory aspects related to corporate bond market development and other types of private capital market development, that Shanghai is not quite there yet. But the idea here, I think, is to use a variety of hubs in order to get the renminbi used a lot more widely and then move the action to Shanghai. If they do actively move forward with the Shanghai project, which I suspect will happen fairly soon, it'll be quite difficult for others to compete. Hong Kong is going to have a strong leg up given the geographical proximity and the fact that a lot of trade goes through here, and there are long-standing historical reasons why this will continue. But I don't think Hong Kong can count on this advantage lasting forever.
Okay, we have time for one last question before we run out. Oh,
hi.
Tara?
Hi. Following on from your question, your remark about Shanghai and Beijing, from your experience talking to people in China, is there really a unified view as to how people want the renminbi to develop? Is there a one sort of sense of how it should internationalize?
No, there isn't. Also, because there are those in China who see more opening up, especially the financial system, as threatening the rents they're able to get from the system. As I briefly alluded to in my talk, the present system works very, very well for the large banks. It works very well for the enterprises and for provincial governors. It's the households who are getting squeezed. So if you think about the broader goal the Chinese government has of rebalancing growth, making sure that more of the benefits of growth go to the average household, the system is not working very well. So I think there are reform-minded officials in China who would like to see a much faster pace of reform, who are willing to see capital account liberalization as a path towards the domestic goals. I don't think any of them, including officials at the PBOC, see the goal of making the renminbi an international currency a goal in itself. It's sort of organically happening. They're willing to encourage the process through steps that help them domestically. But I think the real focus is still largely domestic. The large banks, of course, want to have a greater presence internationally, and this works well for them on that front. But they're less keen about what the implications are for the domestic reforms and how it could upset the apple cart for them. So As with anything else, there are different factions in China, and we will see a not very smooth and not very continuous process of progress with at different times, different groups being able to push their agendas. But it's not a uniformly held view that this is in China's best interests.
Okay, and very quickly, you know, 20-second question, we'll wrap up here. We're at almost at 2 o'clock.
Not sure about 20 seconds, but I put my question. Recently, a lot of foreign investors and foreigners seem to be more upbeat about China and its influence than the local mainland Chinese or, you know, Hong Kong Chinese or whatever Chinese. Now, my question is, the lack of political reform and vested interest in China, do you see it as a stumbling block towards China becoming a subsequent global center, or and hence renminbi as something that will rule the world eventually? You know, I mean, I have heard many people talking about China becoming important, and these people come from capitalism.
So you need among the requirements for countries to attain this important status, including for their currency, one I did not mention is good public institutions that domestic residents as well as international investors have confidence in. So although you have high levels of debt in the US, Japan, and so on, there is a sense that these are economies that will not renege on their obligations. It may well come to that, and we might at some level rue this childlike faith that we have in the US government. And spending my time in Washington, I can tell you that any faith placed in the US government seems a little dicey at this stage. It is true that if China cannot solve, and this is true of many other emerging markets as well, this toxic mix of inequality and corruption, I think, are eroding away support for broader reforms, because there is a sense that the political and economic elite have benefited from this growth disproportionately, and any further liberalization or opening continues to benefit that group. If you take the conversation about multi-brand retail FDI in India, for instance, it's going to ultimately help the common man because it gets around inefficiencies in the distribution system. But the narrative in India is that this is really about the Walmarts to the world coming over and displacing your mom and shop operations. And because of the level of corruption and the fact that the elite have been able to get many of the benefits so far, that narrative has taken hold. So I think in China, India, and many other emerging markets, dealing with these issues of corruption and inequality frontally is going to be very important for their domestic development as well as for them to become major global players.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ishwar. We try to give all of our guests something to remember the club by. I think you may already have one at this rate, but...
okay.
Thank you all for coming. We hope to see many of you more on Thursday. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Yes. No, I don't need it at all. It was a good idea to have the... Yes.
Is it a t-shirt?
I think it's a jacket, but I hope they managed to variety.